Happy New Year, everybody. If you are listening to this podcast on release day, it is New Year's Eve 2013. I wish everybody a very, very happy New Year and lots of success in the year to come. Because of that, we're going to do something a little bit different this week on the Grassroots Motorsports Podcast. This is episode 3. Welcome, everybody, to the Grassroots Motorsports Magazine and Classic Motorsports Magazine podcast. This is, of course, the official podcast of Grassroots Motorsports Magazine and Classic Motorsports Magazine. My name is J.G. Pasterjack, and I wish everybody a happy, happy New Year 2014 here. Release day for this podcast is New Year's Eve 2013. So thanks, everybody, for being with us and for supporting this podcast in a new project that we are trying out for the magazines here. This is an interesting one. So here's the deal with this one. I'm going to, as usual, apologize in advance because this one is an absolute hot mess. This is an interview that we recorded as a test. When we first thought, hey, let's try and do some podcasts, this is what we did as a test, and it is a complete mess. You'll hear Sarah Young, my co-host, is being piped in via Skype, and she's feeding back to all the different mics that are feeding back to each other, and it's just an absolute mess. But it's such a compelling conversation that we wanted to bring it to you guys. And the conversation is with co-owner of our company, Marjorie Suttard. Some of you guys might actually know Margie from going to events or seeing her at the Challenge or the MIDI or one of our other big events, but she has been around since day one. When she was 22 years old, she was married to Tim Suttard, who literally woke up one day and decided to start his own car magazine. So we enlisted her to help us out in doing a little test with this podcast, had a conversation with her, got a lot of our technical bugs worked out. But we were going back through this audio and listening to it, and although we work every day, literally, you know, in offices next to each other, I had never really had this kind of a deep conversation on all these subjects with her at one time. And it's really an extremely cool look into not only publishing a car magazine, but owning a small business today and what it takes for an entrepreneur with a little bit of determination and a little bit of spirit and, you know, a lot of luck and a lot of skill to actually succeed out there. So I think it's a really, really compelling conversation. So I apologize for all the technical glitches and weirdness going on there. You'll hear all kinds of different stuff going on, but just kind of hang with us through that. And I think you'll find that it's a fascinating conversation. So we sort of joined this conversation in the middle a little bit. We just sort of chatted for a while to get her loosened up and get ourselves loosened up a little bit. So when we actually joined this conversation, we're discussing, and here's the thing, you think car magazines have real sexy, cool problems. No, we're actually currently embroiled in a feud with our neighbor behind the office who thinks he owns the fence on the property line and we actually own the fence on the property line, I think. So we're actually in the middle of this giant feud with them because they keep cutting stuff off the fence and it's just a mess. So once again, Happy New Year, everybody. Sarah and I come in after this to close everything out, and we will see you every Tuesday on a new edition of the Grassroots Motorsports and Classic Motorsports Podcast. But for this week, please enjoy our conversation with the boss lady herself and my good friend, Marjorie Suttard.
You know, everything you say, all I hear is my cranky neighbor cut the hell out of my vine and destroyed my fence. I'm going to have to move past that, but it's going to take a minute.
Well, let's start there. Let's start with...
How did I come to be this publishing mogul owner of this fence that's been savaged?
Let's start with the fact that for 30 years, you've owned a business that everybody thinks is incredibly sexy because we get to play with cars all day, but you really deal with stuff like idiot neighbors and fences. So obviously Sarah and I know the story of how it started, but
that's just the one we tell the kids.
That's exactly. So how does one come to start a car magazine at your tender age of what, 23 at the time?
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much all of it right there. If you're 23, your options are limited and your desperation is high. So, yeah, why not? I thought it, honestly, I tell people this and they go, heh, but I thought it would look good on my resume.
So was it something that you saw yourself doing long term? I mean,
no, I actually told Tim I'd give him 4 years.
So there was, even at 23, you had some idea of, like, you weren't just taking steps into your future. You're like, okay, so we'll try this for a while, and then when it doesn't work out. And what was...
That's the only way you can start a business, is believing that whenever you need to, you can pull the ripcord and parachute out, even if it's a fantasy. So that when it's the hardest, when you're the saddest...
Something I've learned by default over the past 2 years.
That's right, that's right. I mean, yeah, most people just get to that point in life and want to retire, and that's their fantasy. But no, when you're starting a business and it feels like it's never going to take off, it's just going to be this endless slog of... For me, responsibility and grown-upness, I could always say, well, I'm just doing this for a little bit, which is how I did it for 30 years. See how that bit me?
So, okay, so that it sounds like, was there a tipping point during those first 4 years, or are you still waiting for that point to tip 30 years later?
No, you know something? There was a moment when people still wanted to buy magazines, and... everybody around us was getting bought out. And so, of course, we were having that conversation. And it was, well, what do you do when, you know, we're probably next. And the guy with the giant suitcase full of money is going to come. And so, you know, we're like, are you going to wear shoes? And you're going to look like in a suit? Or how are you going to meet with this guy? He never came. It was so glass menagerie. But we thought that if this guy came, wait a minute, what would we do? And then we started kind of playing through what we'd go to for a job, what it would pay, what we do with our days. And we realized that we couldn't think of a better option, that we really liked our jobs and our lives. And so we stopped putting on lipstick to go sit in the front room every day. And we weren't doing that anyway, but you were still kind of, you know, thinking, hey, maybe that's what I'm doing. I think most business owners think it might be a startup, and then, you know, you sell it and you start 20 more businesses.
And by front room, you literally mean front room for the first 6 years, 4, 5 years?
Well, yes and no. For the first year we were in, we had this rental house on Beachside, which was great, except all our cars rusted.
It's hard to run a car magazine.
This is in Port Orange.
Daytona Beach. Matter of fact, I called that early phone number not that long ago because we pumped out magazines and cards all over the place with that phone number on it. And it was a residential number because do you know how much they wanted for a business line back in the day? So I called that number just to see what happened. And a lady answered and I asked for Auto X Magazine and she said, I don't know who they are. I don't know where they are. But if you do, could you tell them not to use this number? And if I were a more responsible grown-up person ever, I would have said, I'm sorry, that's me. Please forgive me. Get another number because it's been decades and they're still calling you. It's lost. But
you just hung up real fast.
I hung up and got real busy with a spreadsheet. Okay, what's next today? Anyway, so we had this rental house and we had this whole carport room that wasn't being used. You know, Florida room, jalousy windows all around, view of the neighbor's trash cans backed up against it because it's tiny, tiny little houses. And we thought that prime real estate was just begging to become world headquarters of a national car magazine.
So what was the tipping point then? When did you, I mean, there has to be a moment when you guys woke up or went to sleep or came home or somebody called. Yeah.
Henry Payne. Remember Henry?
Yeah, I remember Henry Payne.
Payne Engineering. And to us, he was this guy who held all the answers because he owned a lot of plastic Porsches. He had a thriving business with his own test track on his grounds. Sorry, Henry, we're not there yet. And he just seemed to be the ultimate entrepreneur, guy that had it all together. And Tim was not crying on his shoulder, but basically saying, well, you know, I get up early to make the donuts and I go to bed really late and the donuts still aren't all made. And Henry said, you know, for me, it was 11 years. Just don't expect it to tip for the first 11 years. And after that, it's like you're on easy street. And I think, again, because we were really young, because we were desperate and inexperienced and had few options, 11 years didn't sound so bad. I mean, you know, how long had you just spent in college and before that high school and before that, if nothing teaches you to wait for something to end, middle school, that's three years. Compare 3 years of middle school to 11 years of entrepreneurship. And I was like, oh, I can do that. It's a hard time, sure. He was pretty close too. 11 years is about when we had the conversation of we don't actually want a guy with a suitcase to show up here. We like our jobs. We like our life.
That would have been after I came along.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You came on when it was still, we were still just running back and forth from one end of the plane to the other.
Yeah.
Throwing crap out and fire extinguishing engines. Yeah.
You know. So did anyone ever come with a suitcase?
Yeah, actually. Not long after we decided we were no longer interested. And it was before we started Classic. Grassroots was going great. We were happy with it. And, yeah, feeling invigorated and all that great stuff. And an English publisher of car magazines approached us. And we politely declined. And it would have involved, most of those deals at the time involved them kind of assimilating you into the Borg. So although they purchased you, you also had a contract and went to work for them. And we'd spent a long time not working for anyone. So we did politely decline. And then when we were launching Classic, our initial title for it was close to the title of one of their publications, and everything had been very amenable, and they were all excited about what we were doing until we politely declined, and then we got a cease and desist on the title.
What was the title?
So, Classic Autosport was the initial title, and there is an Autosport in England, so do the math, and you'll know that it was Haymarket, which rhymes with passive-aggressive bitter, and so we said no. And we're very glad. It was kind of like we got the Hallmark card after that said, you made the right decision because you would have had a miserable life.
I think bitterness is the backbone of this company.
Any company. Come on. Bitterness is the spine of life.
Well, there's a certain, I mean, there's a certain motivation provided by proving the people wrong who thought you would fail all along.
Oh, well, it was great to make that transformation in front of friends and family. Of first, literally, I would have friends call and I'd answer the phone, motorsport marketing, and my closest friend would crack up and go, no, it's not, it's Margie's family room. It's like, shut up, it's world headquarters, I'm at work, what do you want? So, yeah, it was hard, actually, to transition past, hey, we were many members of staff into it and a couple of office buildings into it before family stopped saying, so how you doing with that? Are you able to, are you doing it full time now? Yeah, me and half a dozen other people, yeah.
But going back, there were times in the early days when
we used to pay you and then ask for a loan after we gave you your check. Even
beyond that, I mean, there were times that, and probably this is a big part of the reason that we're still around is that I guess the best way to put it is you learn to improvise as a business owner.
Have you ever seen the numbers on businesses that start in recessionary periods and their success rate versus businesses that start in the fat times? Markedly better performs by people who start when they're doomed.
So do you think I mean, you had no publishing background. Tim had, you know, a little bit of marketing background.
That's not true. I worked for a realtor, and he was in the Rotary Club, and I totally did his newsletter, and he put his name on it every week. And so I thought I was ready. And Tim had worked for an ad agency, so he knew all about everything else.
So at some point, like,
that's how young and dumb we were.
Well, yeah, and you're constantly wondering to yourself, is, am I getting by because it just so happens I'm good at it, or am I succeeding because I'm too stupid to know what failure looks like?
It's all of the above. Yeah. And then other boring business reading, because this is kind of how I put I don't sleep well, so I really like stultifyingly boring stuff to read, was this interesting study on improvisation and how established companies they basically factualize themselves out of it, because they run the numbers on especially innovation at the bottom end. And they say, you know what, the profit margin on that is non-existent. We require more for our overhead. You know, we're already established here. If this little guy comes in with this little piece of crap and takes this much of my market segment, no big deal. I can afford to lose it. And they bump themselves upstairs until before you know it, they are jaded, bland, generic magazines that don't actually have an individual reader anymore. The individual reader has become an amorphous decision matrix of profit margins and market research. And then someone comes in and says, I got a guy who wants to hear this because that guy's me, and so I'm going to write to suit it. And so we were that kind of bottom-end innovation, and designed to be. I mean, one of the reasons we started where we started with Autocross magazine was to have a strong niche, or all of a sudden, why? It was a niche publication, and now everyone says niche. That just makes me want to puke. Niche? Really? Even houses have niches now. It's a niche. Yeah. Damn it. Anyway, that's why we started there, and that's how our amazingly scant knowledge of publishing served us. We just had to get it out.
So I know plenty of these stories, but it's always fun to hear you tell them. There has to be a moment sometime in those first few years when you thought it might be a tipping point the other way, and it was the oh wow, why am I doing this again? What was that phone call or knock on the door?
You know, it's funny. It should have been the phone call when the motorhome blew up for the third time on the same trip. Literally, the engine had exploded, been replaced, exploded, been replaced. This one exploded. And we didn't have money for motorhome engines. We didn't have money for anything. These were in the days when I still parked my 2002. Every once in a while, I just happened to park on top of the water meter. Because, yeah, we owned a Water Witch, too. Improvisation, baby. So anyway, I got the call, and Tim said it blew up again. And
that was Nebraska, right?
He was in Grand Island, Nebraska, and he had run across a bridge. And I mean, it's like almost like the Book of Mormon, this story. You know, there's coyotes howling in the background and getting closer, and dark, deserted interstate, which tells you how long ago that was. And this poor boy man publisher running across the bridge, and no, I won't stop. And no, actually, he was like, F this. Yeah. So he called me and he said, I've had it towed to this gas station there. There's a guy that has an old Suburban. He can cut the hitch off of the motorhome in about an hour, and I can throw everything out of the motorhome into it, hook it up to the trailer, because we were towing a race car, and I can be back on the road, and I think I can still make Chicago for our event. What do you think? And I was like, do it. Walk away. Just walk away. We had restored that motorhome. It had new curtains. I sewed cushions for it. I'm a good sewer. I, you know, just want to say, put that out there in case anybody needs anything. And I was done. I'm sure that if you live in Grand Isle, Nebraska, If there's a planter that looks like a Travco motorhome, it's mine. So, yeah, there was that. That was probably was the closest tipping point. If we hadn't been able to make that event and keep going, that was sponsorship money we would have had to give back. And that probably would have sunk us. And there was that moment of, screw it, throw it in this burb. We're going. And that kind of made me feel like, yeah, we can do anything.
So three decades later, basically, what's the... As much as we seem like we're winging it at times, there is a plan, and we do kind of know where we're going. But what's the least expected sort of thing about what we're doing today?
Definitely all the digital products. When we started, I was cutting edge by calling writers and telling them when to drop their phone receiver into the acoustic coupler. And you know, once we got the handshaking and the baud rate and everything set, they could modem me a story, man. You could see it go across the screen as fast as you'd type it. The letters just kept showing up. So, yeah, I should have had an inkling being there on the cutting edge. But no.
And we were literally cutting things out and pasting them.
That's how you made magazines. Yeah. Again, we were cutting edge by getting rid of that. And again, like everything else, it was desperation. And it was also no institutional allegiance to the way it had always been done. You know, there were guys that had brands of waxers they actually cared about to wax, you know, these rollers that would melt the wax onto your pasteboard so you could then stick down the galleys of type and the photos that you'd sent out to have printed at certain size reductions, you know, 68% please crop here, and you'd wait and get them back. And, you know, great for them. I'm glad that they had that rich career and life of perusing the catalogs full of tape lines that they could stick down on it. But for us, again, we didn't have our own photo processor, so we didn't, typesetter. We were depending on galleys that we would send out to different printers or independent typesetters around town as they had downtime. And really a turning point was the time that the guy forgot to put it in Fixer, run it long enough in the Fixer. And, type was, it was like a photo. If you didn't fix it, I can tell you that you would pin it up all over the bamboo blinds of your Florida room office on Friday. And when you came back Monday morning, you had a lot of white strips. It looked like a cash register receipt had blown up all over your room. Not a word of type on it. So there were...
That's the 1987 version of not hitting save, basically.
Yes, only there's no file again. There's here. You take the stories back down and say, dude, type it again. And yeah, you wait another week. And so we were happy when Mac introduced the laser writer. When the laser writer printer came out, we went, it makes type! And nobody else seemed to get that. Everyone else was far enough along and had high enough standards that they didn't want laser type in their end product magazine. But laser type that we could proof and correct ourselves. We weren't cutting letters out with an X-Acto knife and sticking in the right letter. That was a world better for us. I mean, it was, our writing got better as soon as we had more time to revise it. We weren't tied on just sending it out to this guy. And never mind, we didn't have that soul-sucking experience of dealing with whatever crabbed itself in and said, I'm a typesetter, here, give me your stuff. Sorry, all the typesetters of the world, by the way. It's a beautiful craft. So that's how we kind of got into it.
The last thing I wanted to talk about, and you can, I will leave this open to where you can answer it as personally or as professionally as you like.
Oh, I can't wait for this one.
But for essentially except for a couple of jobs in college and a couple of years, your entire professional life you have spent working with your spouse.
Oh yeah.
So what would you say? And there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there that you know might be in that same situation or be contemplating that same situation. So how do you make that work, or how do you choose to
the quick answer is what Tim has always said, and his quip is always, it's been not working for 30 years. The longer answer is that, you know, we talk about our backgrounds and our ambitions and our desperation for jobs leading us to this, but at the very heart of it, and what was really the tipping point to we're starting our own business, was we were newly married and found a house we liked, and we were doing everything just by the book, which can feel great and it can feel terrifying too. And so, you know, we're riding that moving sidewalk into adulthood, and then we realized that we had some contract negotiations on the house. You know, our first offer wasn't accepted. We're going back and forth. And all of a sudden, we both stepped back and looked at each other and said, let's talk about this for a minute, because if we do this, we don't ever get off the moving sidewalk. You know, we live in the airport terminal forever, ever, 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 ever. That's it. You just go back and forth like with everybody else. If we use the money we were going to use for this house and we start our own business, then it's more of a marriage. We spend our days together. We do something together. Because when I say moving sidewalk, honestly and truly, for most people, they get on different sidewalks every morning and it goes someplace else. And they only come back at night. And I don't know, do you spend, and I don't know any other way, but for us, we're very obviously childish, literal people. And for us, it seemed like you would grow apart and you would have less in common. You weren't doing that thing. So I don't know. I'm choking up in a little bit at my own idiocy because the friction it brings. Yeah, all you entrepreneurs out there, it's pretty much the equivalent of, hey, y'all, watch this marriage-wise. It's incredibly stupid, and it's probably going to hurt, and it is a lot of together time.
It sounds like if you can make it work, it kind of makes everything better, maybe in a Stockholm syndrome kind of way.
maybe my definitions of marriage are totally skewed. Yeah, because, yeah, for me, yeah, two go in, two go out. That's it. Yeah, it's not two go in, one go out kind of deal. So that's how we've played it. That said, his office is almost always a long walk away from mine. Mm-hmm. He always...
And I mean, you... not just physically, but professional. I mean, you've structured yourself at sort of naturally adversarial parts of the business.
Well, yeah, I think it's very good for, you know, it's a little bit of the, you know, Houses of Congress where, well, that's a bad analogy, but as ideally set up, yes, you have some natural tension between the parts of self, so that you know that it doesn't run rampant. I don't know. I don't know really crap about that, obviously. But you have some natural tension and some natural checks and balances to keep you from going, why, yes, I think I should buy every single car. So this way we buy every other car. you have some way to kind of left brain and right brain the thing at the same time. And we've actually taken turns being the left and the right brains. You know, sometimes he's the creative guy and I'm the numbers drone. And there have been times when I was the writer person and he was just selling and working business plans. That's been another great thing. You know, we've had the same jobs for 30 years, but we haven't. I've had half a dozen jobs over the past 30 years. I've done everything here but sell ads. Tim's done everything here but, you know, be the actual editor, even though people always call him the editor, ironically. there's a lot to find here. It's not like we did open up a donut shop, you know. Once you run through the gamut of sprinkles, what's left? We got more options.
Well, I think we found the natural endpoint then. Thanks for playing along, and being a boss willing to help us out with a stupid project.
Does this mean I can start playing with the mic again?
It does mean you can start playing with the mic again.
Awesome. It's cool. I'm going to do it right now.
All right. So I'd love to say I learned a few things, but those are all stories that I've heard in the past. But it does my heart good to be able to share those stories with everybody, I think.
Yeah, if you could follow along with all of the metaphors, maybe you. Yeah, it's a deep read. You need to go back and listen again, maybe.
All right, so don't forget, if you want to subscribe to one of our magazines, you can do so at a discount, grassrootsmotorsports.com/discount or classicmotorsports.net/discount. That'll get you like $5 off regular subscription price, and we would be honored if you would take us up on that offer. So until next time, I am JG Pasterjack.
And I'm Sarah Young.
And we'll see you on the next edition of the Grassroots Motorsports / Classic Motorsports podcast. Here's your homework assignment. Start thinking of a name for this podcast. It's very, very long.
So preferably one that doesn't have a slash in it and is 80 syllables long.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. We'll see you next time, everybody. Thanks very much.
Thank you.